You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Every paranormal investigator has one location that has shaken them to the core. For Daryl Marston, it was the House of Wills in Cleveland, Ohio. What occurred made Daryl reevaluate himself as a person and as a paranormal investigator. As the co-lead investigator on two seasons of Ghost Hunters, Daryl explains what happened to him and the other investigators on that night. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters on Patreon at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also sign up at Apple Podcasts too by looking for Mysteries and Monsters. You can also click the link in the show notes too. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also find us at mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes and merchandise. Our intro and outro music is provided by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. The House of Wills is a location full of mystery, and as Daryl Marston found out, much, much more besides. On today's episode, I'm delighted to welcome Daryl Marston, co-lead investigator on A&E's Ghost Hunters. In his new book, The Horrors of the House of Wills, Daryl recounts his investigation into this notorious property that challenged him in every way possible. Daryl, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thank you for having me.
My absolute pleasure. Before we dive into the book, I'm always interested when I hear about people who seem to accidentally find themselves becoming involved in the paranormal, because you were bought a trip by your mum, I believe, to sort of visit a local haunted location as a birthday present.
Actually, it was her birthday.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it was actually our birthdays are one day apart. Hers is Halloween. Hers is Halloween. Mine's November 1st.
All right.
But she was going to this haunt location. This is back in 2005 to kind of catch people up. And I didn't know what a ghost hunter was or a paranormal investigator. Because even back then, I mean, 20 years ago almost, it was kind of taboo. No one really talked about it. And so I reluctantly went. I was like, okay, let's do this. All right, whatever, Mom, it's for you. So I went, and I tell you, I'm glad I did, because it sent my life in a completely different direction. Because I actually, the night we were there, we were only there maybe 3 hours. I actually witnessed my first paranormal experience, which was a half-body apparition my first time out. Mm. So, yeah, and then I was hooked. I wanted to try to figure out what I saw, recreate it. Man, I tell you, I hit the ground running and never stopped. It was, it was a hobby. Never thought it would lead me to where I'm at today, but here I am.
Mm. It is. I mean, sometimes when people have these kind of experiences, Daryl, especially when it's your first real dipping your toe into that kind of field and you have an experience such as you did that night, sometimes people will think that fate can sometimes push people in a direction they might not expect them to have gone to. I would imagine, like we said, you didn't really have much interest in the paranormal. You were aware of it, and I know you've got some sort of paranormal history that you hadn't kind of been aware of in one of the homes you had growing up. So is it surprising when you look back at how passionate you've become from someone who essentially had to be strong-armed to accompany your mum to that night?
Yeah. I mean, the passion, when it gets into you, man, that hook, especially with the paranormal, because you're dealing with stuff that you can't see here or something you can't see, you know, physically sometimes. But I saw it physically. I physically saw this apparition, and it wasn't a human, or wasn't a human, a living human. And to have that happen, it's like almost being reborn. You're like, okay, everything that you know, this world around you, these, you know, we put these blinders on and we go through the world every day, you know, working and getting up and paying the bills and raising a family. That kind of goes out the door a little bit, because now you have this whole other thing going on around you that you didn't, you know, maybe you believed, you didn't believe. Maybe you're a skeptic. I'm still a skeptic to this day, but there is something else out there, and there's something going on around us that we don't see all the time. And we kind of, as human beings, I think we're so busy in the, you know, day-to-day grind, we kind of shut ourselves off from it. And that's one thing nice about, you know, being able to go to and investigate for a lot of people, is because you can turn all that off. You go into a haunted location and you open yourself up, and you're not worrying about, you know, getting up for work or paying the bill, or that all goes away for 10 hours, you know, 8 hours, whatever. And you can just kind of concentrate on what's around you, and you know, things are going on. I think that's why back, you know, a couple hundred years ago, it was so prevalent. You know, people were, you know, talking more about, you know, especially during the, like the spiritualism, you know, age, because they didn't have a daily grind. We didn't have all the things to kind of, you know, distract us, like cell phones and TV and iPads and things of that nature. And people were more open to it. These days, it's, you know, but believe me, compared to 2005, 20 years ago almost, to now, it's a whole different ballgame. It's not taboo. It's on every TV channel you turn on anymore. There's movies about it. There's books about it. Yeah, so it's pretty wild to see.
Yeah. So from those early days, Daryl, did you kind of just set yourself off thinking, right, I'm going to get a list of all the local haunted locations and legends and sort of start small and build up? Or yeah, did you suddenly, as you were saying, you were bitten immediately with this passion?
I was bitten, but back then, I mean, internet wasn't as big as it is now. So you couldn't just go on Facebook or and see a million posts from all these haunted locations. So you had to go to a bookstore. You had to know people. I knew nobody. I mean, nobody. It was just me when I started out. And then I met my wife. We started dating at the time, and she kind of she thought it was really cool. Yeah. And kind of got into it, and we tagged up, and we just start hitting the road. And I learned by, you know, just getting out there and doing it, man, sink or swim. And it's back then it was so hard to find places. And so what you do is you go to like a place like Gettysburg here in the States, yeah, where it's known for all its hauntings, and you'd rent a B&B for the weekend. Yeah. And you go stay in a B&B for the weekend and hope you capture something, which, you know, sometimes you did, sometimes you didn't, but it was still fun. It's more the hunt that's the fun part. And then when you do catch something, it's great. It's a story to tell, you know?
I suppose as well, as you refer to there, Daryl, from when you started to where you are nowadays, the kit that you probably take with you has changed so dramatically. When you think even you know, as we talk, how smartphones from their real infancy back in 2005, where, you know, the majority of us couldn't even possibly consider affording one, to essentially near enough every phone you see these days is a smartphone that's super connected with excellent cameras. So it's amazing how quickly it's gone.
They're an extension of us anymore. They are like an extension of the human body, the human brain anymore, these smartphones, unfortunately. I mean, they're kind of like a necessary evil. Yeah. Because you need them for everything. You need them to go to the store. You need them because your credit cards are on them now. Everything's on them. So it's like an extension of you, which, yeah, you know, I'm not a big fan of, but I understand it. And, you know, back then, you didn't have all that. And the kit back then, I had nothing to start out with. I started out with a recorder. That was it. I bought a cheap recorder from Radio Shack because there was no Amazon, wasn't really a thing. So you couldn't just go on Amazon and order, you know, a recorder or anything. So, yeah, you go to Radio Shack or, you know, Walmart or whatever and buy a recorder. And that's all I started out with. And then I started, you know, over the years, collecting little things here and there. I was never a big kit guy, though, man. To be honest with you, I'm not really into the tech part of it. I mean, I have a lot of tech. I mean, I've got cases of tech on our desk right behind me here. I never used it. I mean, I use it once or twice. And I just lose interest in it because there's so many, especially some of the stuff that's out there, especially the older stuff, so many false positives with it. You really can't, I mean, it's fun. Yeah, you have a good time with it, but you can't prove anything with it, like really prove anything with it. So that's why I always a recorder or a good camera was always my go-to.
Yeah. I mean, often I think sometimes you can get a little bit overawed or too reliant on the latest tech, Daryl, and it becomes a bit of a one-upmanship, keeping up with the Joneses, that you've got all this equipment, and like you say, most of the time it'll give you a false positive, or it simply doesn't seem to work in the way that you want it to.
Yeah, and it's distracting at times. Like I do events all over the country for different paranormal teams. I go, like, the public will come out, they'll sell tickets or anything. And I've been to, you know, somewhere, man, you go into a location and they got so much crap everywhere, and you can't even walk in a room without lights going off and REM pods, and like just to walk in the room, like you're setting them off, and it's so distracting at times. Like you can't really investigate that way, in my opinion. You gotta kind of like, I mean, I like going into a location, forget all the tech, maybe have one or two pieces of tech with you or whatever, a good recorder, a good camera. I'm really big into body cams, like the first responders use. Because it's like having a second set of eyes, to be honest with you, and you don't have to worry about it. You just clip it on. It's very light. The IR on it is amazing. The audio on it are amazing. And they're like that because the police and first responders have to rely on that footage. So it's got really good footage and really good audio. I've caught some of my best EVPs ever on my body cam, not with a recorder, but on my body cam audio. So yeah, I'll just clip something like that on if I'm being serious and not trying to, you know, entertain people. And I'll have, you know, like I said, you know, good audio recorder, and I'll just go in and just kind of just act like a normal day, not like I'm going in to harass any, you know, entity or spirit or to interrogate them. I see that a lot too. You'll see the whole softball questions, you know, like, you know, when'd you die? What year is it? Do you know your dad? You're like, oh God. it's just like, okay, guys, all right, this is, I know it's your first day, but let's tone it down a bit and let's just chill out, sit in a room and have a normal conversation with ourselves. And yeah, a lot of times what will happen is if you're running an audio recorder or a couple pieces of equipment, whatever's there is going to come in and wonder what you're up to and kind of join it. I always try to tell people, think of it this way. Think you're at a party and you're in the kitchen and there's 20 people in a room in the living room just having a good time and laughing and having fun. And you're in there by yourself and you're kind of tuning into their conversation. So you gravitate to that. Think of it like that. Think of it like, you know, okay, yeah, this entity is a human. Nine times out of 10, 99.9% of the time, it was a human entity. And it's going to gravitate to the conversation as well. And that's, you know, that's when you start getting cool, really cool stuff.
I'm intrigued by the new book, Daryl, because by the time you get to this location, you'd been hunting for what, 9 years, nearly 10 years?
Perhaps? 9 or 10, yeah. This was in 2014, so I started in 2005. Yes, yeah, about 9 years.
And when I've read the book, you seem very sort of humble about how the person you were before you went there and how you've been since.
Yeah.
And that you needed this to bring you back down to earth. Do you think that was just because you kind of got caught up in the ghost hunt prior to this building, making sort of checking you back into line, as it were?
Yeah, I think what a lot of it was is back then the TV shows. Everyone's watching these damn TV shows, and nothing against TV shows. I made my name on the TV shows, but it's you're mimicking them, you know, at that point. Like you watch so many of them. That's why I stopped watching them. I stopped watching paranormal TV. I still don't watch paranormal TV. But I stopped watching them. But yeah, at that time, you know, it's ingrained in your head. This is how you investigate. You go in there, you know, kicking in doors and asking all these crazy questions. And when that happened to me, the House of Wills, when I went there, I'd never dealt with an investigation like that. I've heard of them, and I thought they were, excuse my language, bullshit.
Yep.
I didn't think there was, you know, to me, it was Hollywood jargon. And it humbled me, man, because I'd never dealt with that kind of energy, that kind of darkness. And that's, it really played havoc in my life. And it humbled me as not just as an investigator, but as a human being to know that that's actually out there. That stuff, some of the stuff you see on TV, on the movies, like, you know, Amityville and other books like that, is true. It's real. And you don't think it can happen, but it happens, man. And it happened to me, and I'm a firm believer in it.
I suppose prior to that, Daryl, you'd have probably been told dozens of times about this is the most haunted location you could ever come to. Was this one the first time that you thought, yeah, because I know everything about the start of it, how the investigation kind of, it's all one of those things. Once again, it seems to be, it needed to happen for you, I think, as you,
oh, yeah,
you kind of refer to in the book. But even from driving there and pulling up outside, it all seems to be very odd. I mean, it's a very odd building with a bit of a notorious and strange past as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's got a really checkered past, and it's got a really rich history as well. Not just bad, but good. And that's, you have all these different layers, which I think is what makes it so incredible and so much energy there, because you have all those layers. And I think those layers, the good and bad in that building, are constantly at odds. It's, you know, kind of like the yin and yang factor. Yeah, you know, when you're just pulling up to that location, it's very ominous. You can't tell by the the pictures, you know, yeah, it looks crazy, but you can't put the scale of the building to it until you get there and you see how large this location. I mean, it's got a full two-story cathedral in it, in the our auditorium in the middle of it, which people don't understand. And like, you look at the building from outside, like it can't be that big, and you get inside, and it's like you walked into like a football sized arena. Mm. It doesn't make sense. It's the way the building was designed. It was designed by a 32nd degree Masonic architect who also was a member of the Knights Templar, and he designed the building to actually harness energy. Mm. And that's what, you know, and this is also been verified by Eric Freeman, who is the owner of the building, because he's done a lot of research to try to, you know, put names to things and why it was built that way. And yeah, so he built the location for that. And I think that's why it's able to harness that type of energy. When you get there, so it's ominous outside. And this is nothing against East Cleveland. I love Cleveland. I was just there last weekend for a book signing. But East Cleveland is not the best neighborhood. A lot of gang-related crime there, shootings, things of that nature. Mm. So you got the outside factor, which is already crazy enough. And then when you get inside this building, it's like, wow, the energy is nothing like you've ever felt. It's an energy that I can only explain, and I've told, you know, hundreds of people this already, that it's the only place I've ever been to where it actually feels like a living organism, like the building is alive. Not just that it's haunted by spirits, but it's alive. I feel like, and it's not just me saying this, a lot of people have said this, that it almost feels like it feeds off of human energy. And it needs that human energy to kind of keep going. And then, you know, when it doesn't have that, it just lays dormant for a while until it gets it.
Do you think as well? I mean, I'm always amazed when you can go into a building like this. And like you say, Eric Freeman has purchased it after, I think it had been abandoned for the best part of 10 years.
About 10 years, yeah.
And yet when you walk in there, there's still the original papers and posters and belongings to the previous owner who had passed away. And then obviously there'd been some sort of criminal activity that was going on that ended up seeing the city get involved and all kinds of stuff going on, Daryl.
Correct.
I mean, I still find it amazing that sometimes it's like people have just got up and walked out and locked the door behind them and just left everything behind. It's a very strange thing. Do you come across that a lot, or was this a different level of that kind of sort of visual history that you could basically just pick up and look at and know who used to live there?
I've had that happen before in locations where you walk into them and maybe they've been closed for, you know, a year or two, several years. And there's still like artifacts there. There's still, you know, paperwork from the, you know, the business or pictures from a family. This place was different, man. You still had stuff in there from the civil rights movement. There's still posters in there, Martin Luther King posters, because Martin Luther King actually did a lecture from that building back in the 1960s during the civil rights movement. So you have an attic that had piles of civil rights stuff in it, and other artifacts, you know, left over from the building. You still have chairs in the building, you know, like they were just left there and people walked away. There were still offices with like paperwork, you know, tacked to the to the pegboards, you know, for dates, for like calendars and things like that. There was a calendar in there. I remember. I think it dated back to 2002 when the building closed. It's pretty wild seeing that. It was like almost like some apocalyptic, you know, thing where you're walking in, you know, through some town or something that's, you know, got shut down because of, you know, some, you know, some virus or something. It was pretty wild seeing that stuff still in the building and being a part of it. You felt like you kind of stepped back in history a little bit.
Mm. It does seem a very strange situation as well when you guys go there, because obviously, as we've said, Eric Freeman had bought the property.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it seemed like most of the building was still in disrepair. How long had he owned it, Daryl, when you guys had gone, or had he just purchased it?
He'd only owned it for maybe 2 or 3 years at that point. I think he bought it in 2011 or 2012. I know it's in the book. But he didn't have the money at the time. So he bought the property. He fell in love with the property. He was drawn to the property. He bought it. And it was like a buy on the whim type thing. Like it was the right price. The city was selling it. They were trying to get rid of it, or they were going to tear it down and make a parking lot. So he went in, he bought the property, and now what? Now I don't have the money to do anything with it. Where am I going to find the money to, you know, try to save this building? Because the roof was shot. It was leaking water everywhere. There had been vandalism, people breaking in and stealing. So there's all these factors. So he was stuck, you know, and he's trying to raise money. And the place is so huge. It takes millions to fix a property like that. It's not like a house. It's not like, you know, a 3-bedroom house. This is a property that had upwards of 90 some rooms in it.
Yeah.
So you have a roof over top of it. That's the first thing you got to fix, because it's leaking water in certain locations and, you know, destroying the property with inside. So yeah, he dealt with that for a while, and and now he's in good standing, so he can, you know, he's got money where he's putting back into the property, and he's trying to, you know, get it back to a room at a time, of course, get it back to its, you know, its heyday and try to, you know, and save it, because he loves the building. He really does. He has a love for it. And I could see that in him when I talked to him. Like, I was just with him last Friday in Cleveland, but he came to my book signing. It's the first time I ever met Eric personally. Physically in person. I've talked to him many times on the phone and through Zoom calls and things of that nature. So I had to get his permission to write the book because his name's in it, of course. You could tell his passion and his love for the property. and to try to save it and to make it something better for the community.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. So is he using it through his personal wants to do this, or is this as a part of the Church of Satan? Because obviously you've got this in the mix as well, Daryl.
Well, yeah, he I think originally that's what he was using the building for when he first, because that's all he could do there. He really didn't have I don't think he had a game plan in the beginning on the direction he wanted to go with it. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I never really discussed that with him. But now I know he's trying to, actually turn the building around and make it into like an art center or a social club for the community. So people can come there and visit. They can see the art. They can see, because he's into art and things of that nature. Which, I explained a little bit of that in the book, some of the, stuff that he's done, which I don't, it's not my thing, but who am I to knock him, and tell him what art is. I think in the beginning it was more or less, okay, I got this building, I have this following of, my religion, let's do this with it. And I think he got a lot of slack for that. He really did. The community kind of turned on him because of that. And there were some videos out there that were floating around, like YouTube and social media, of some of these rituals. And I think that, came out in the community. I do know this past weekend, because when I went to Cleveland, I also had an interview on Fox News in Cleveland. And he was a little concerned on any outlash. He was like just waiting for the bomb to drop again. Like I remember sitting at the book signing that night, and I'd done the interview like 11 o'clock in the day, and it was a live interview. And he was a little concerned. He's like, he was just waiting for some kind of outlash because I was talking. I was like rehashing the House of Wills to Cleveland, and it opened a lot. I guess it opened a lot of people's eyes to the location that didn't even know it existed there. It was pretty wild. Like half the people there know about it, and half the people don't know about it. I think he did okay. I haven't heard anything from him since, Friday or Saturday. So hopefully everything's all right.
Well, clearly you hadn't upset him that much, Daryl, or so he wouldn't have come to the book signing, I would imagine.
No. He was great, man. I tell you, I didn't know I didn't know how our first time meeting would go. And he was very open arms. We became really good friends. I respect the man very much. And I have his back, and I'll help him any way I can possible. I know he is doing tours there to kind of like people really want to see the building now. So he kind of opened up tours, which is great. It's great for him. It'll help him raise money for the location. And so it's interesting to see, because I'm a devout Christian. I follow Jesus. And then you have this other person, you got the other side, like, the angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other. Type situation here with him and I, but it's nice to see that two of people from two totally different belief systems can come together and do this book, be professional with one another, and actually kind of build this friendship that we're building.
I suppose as well, Daryl, that's one of the great things. This traumatic investigation really clearly has had a profound and positive effects on the rest of your life after this.
Yeah.
Which I think is quite difficult, because obviously the aftermath of it was quite challenging with what was going on. So when you look back at when you set foot in this strange, I mean, obviously you'd got the caretakers telling you all kinds of things. I think Patty had this incident with what she thought, she was being chased by someone holding an axe down several floors. I mean, and that's literally within about what, a couple of hours of you getting there?
Yeah, I heard that story. I actually heard from her maybe 5 hours into the investigation. She'd actually stopped, but she wasn't able to get there when we first got there. And she showed up out of nowhere, man. It's like she just appeared in the building. It was very odd. like she was been there the whole time. And she sat down and she did like a little interview with us, cause we were doing like a YouTube channel at the time. And she told that story, and it was quite insane to hear that. She was shook by it. She still was shook by it. That's why she would never go to that building again by herself, because of that situation. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to all intents and purposes, there was nobody found as well, Darryl, which makes me think, was this some kind of manifestation? And if it was, I mean, goodness, regardless.
Yeah, well, the crazy thing is the police found the axe.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they didn't find anybody. Now take it. There are a lot of places to hide in that building. It is huge.
Yes.
And there are other ways to get out. If you want to crawl through like a window or something like that, it's quite possible. You know, mm-hmm. if there was someone there, they could have got out another way. It's crazy. It's a crazy story, man. I believe her. I totally believe her to this day, because she was really shook by it. And she'd been going there for years. I think she even was going, you know, she was there before Eric even owned the building. She was kind of like the caretaker and doing like paranormal stuff there. But she had never had that type of experience before there, you know, and she thinks things had changed. Yeah, with some of the rituals were coming into the building, some of the artifacts, the demonic artifacts that were brought to the building. The atmosphere completely changed from, you know, within a couple of months. It went from a happy type, not really happy type haunting, but it was a haunting to this. It went to a whole different level of craziness and activity, and it switched from, you know, being just a haunting to a very dark haunting where people were, you know, getting, you know, attachments, and, you know, people were, you know, I've done interviews since the book, talking to people who'd been there even before I was there, and hearing their stories, and like there's one, the common, you know, denominator between everybody who went there was in each group, like if there could be 5 people, 10 people or 2 people, one person always had some kind of attachment when they left that building. So it always found somebody to latch onto, whether it be, I don't know if it's because they were the alpha. I don't know if they're the omega. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that common denominator is, but there's always this attachment or some kind of like almost possession of someone like flipping out and going crazy in the building during an investigation, where people had to hold them down or had to remove them from the building, or going home and having something follow them home like it did with me. So it was really strange, you know, seeing that between all these different investigators who don't know each other, never met each other, never heard the stories. And have, you know, with me, same thing, you know, have something follow me home and, you know, kind of play havoc on my life for a while there.
Mm. Do you think there are properties like this, Darryl, as you mentioned earlier, that you feel as though it's almost alive or a living entity, and it's just there festering away, waiting for the right ingredients? I know you mentioned in the book that, perhaps, as you were saying, this high point in paranormal television, do you think a lot of people had come playing paranormal investigator and being aggressive and confrontational and rubbing things up the wrong way? So it was always going to get worse after so many people started visiting it.
Yeah, because you don't know what people are doing. You don't, especially when they were doing, like, they were at their heyday with the investigations. So they were doing paranormal investigations. There's like, basically, people will pay, you go, and, like, no one was monitoring it. No one was there watching them, or someone would check in with them every few hours. You don't know what people are doing in that building. I've seen locations that were completely good locations, a great haunt, and then you have people start coming in. I would go back, say I'd do an investigation there. Great place. Nothing really bad there happened. You go back a year later and things were completely different, and you'd be like, what happened? You know, what's going on here? And then you find out people are coming in doing rituals, Ouija boards, you know, doing all kinds of seances. And that just opens up, you know, negative energy. If it's there, it's going to come in. If you're, you know, you're letting it in at that point, and you see these these locations change, man, like overnight. It's really strange to see sometimes, especially when you know it wasn't like that when you were there before, or the ten times you've been before, and all of a sudden you go back and it's completely different. Prime example, there's a location in New Jersey that I get invited back to once or twice a year to do it, events there. And I'm not going to name the location because I don't want to throw them under the bus or anything, but I've been going there for 5 years now doing investigations and with the public and having a great time. And, last fall, I got invited back last September for an investigation there for the public. And I went there and it was different. It was completely different. And I'm like, what's going on here? Like, you know, things were getting like, it was negativity. You could feel it.
Yeah.
So I started asking questions like, I'm like, what's going on here? What happened? There's something happened on it. And then like, no, not that we know. I mean, we do our investigations like always. And then the lady was like, oh yeah, did you hear about the movie they made here? I'm like, nah, what movie? So it was like a low budget film. Yeah, they came here and made a movie, and in the movie they did some rituals in the movie. I'm like, oh really? Like what kind of rituals? And they were doing Ouija board stuff and having fun with it. I was like, oh, well, there you go. I mean, that's why things, you know, I'm not saying that's why it happened, but that definitely could be it. So it's stuff like that. You know, you don't know. You need somebody there to kind of monitor people because, or make rules. You know, I see a lot of places I go, like, they'll have a waiver you have to sign in, like, hey, no Ouija boards, no seances, no this, no that. And for good reason, not that I believe in all that, but some people do. And you know that, you know, if you believe in something enough and you're putting it out there and manifesting it, it could happen.
Well, I suppose as well, it all depends on how people react to their environment as well, Darryl. If they're dabbling in such things or perhaps aren't very experienced, or they're just, some, you know, one of them might be there trying to wind everybody else up, especially when you're in a location that you've never been to before. You've got to be really careful and treat not only the property, but the people with you with respect. And sometimes that clearly isn't going on, is it?
Yeah, no, definitely not. I mean, because everybody's out to make a YouTube video and be the next big thing. Not everybody, but some people are. And that's what you get. You'll keep people coming here, have no idea what they're doing, especially when they're messing with the dark arts and things of that nature. They see it on TV or they see it in a movie, or they read it on, you know, social media and they think they can do it. Well, yeah, you're going to, you know, and you go in there and you start messing around. You're not just, you know, hurting yourself, but you're hurting the property and other people who are there, by bringing that negative dark energy into the location by doing rituals and things of that nature. Because if there is anything there and anything, you know, a little, you know, to the right or to the left that, you know, is a little bit darker, it will latch onto that energy. You're putting it out there. It's going to respond. And that's what people don't understand. And they don't, you know, they don't have to stay there. They get to go home at the end of the night. And then you leave that location holding the bag of whatever you just did there, which is not fair.
When you look back at that investigation then, Darryl, how long into it did you start to think this was a little bit out of the ordinary? This was
a bad idea?
Yeah. Well, or worse to that effect, yeah. What time did you think, why am I doing this?
It was pretty quick, to be honest with you, because we were, not just myself, but I mean, within an hour or so of being there, we were having all kinds of weird things happen. Like, you know, just, you know, and some of it could be, you know, you're psyching yourself out. But when it's not just you and the other three people you're with starts having visions and things of that nature, and it's just weird things happening. Like I said, the neighborhood was not inviting. They don't want you there, for one thing. The people in that neighborhood do not want you there. And they make you quite, they'll roll up on you and ask you why you're in their neighborhood. That's the type of neighborhood it is. Mm-hmm. So you have that. You have this dark location that you're in that the energy is just way off, man. It was pretty quick. It was within the first hour or two. You're like, this is going to be crazy. If we make it through the night, I mean, you know, because the thing was, too, another thing back when this was happening – the stories were that no one ever makes it the whole night through the House of Wills. That's what they would tell you. Like, most people leave around one or two. Like, they, at that point, they're done. Like, they can't deal with it anymore. We actually stayed till like 7 a.m. The sun was coming up.
Yeah.
So I think that too, on top of it, us putting ourselves through that, it was like almost a challenge. And dealing with that, it was just like weight on your shoulders the whole time you're in that building of this nasty, dark energy. I think that, you know, looking back at it now, I mean, that probably did not help the matter at all, and probably why something did follow me home. Looking at it and saying, okay, yeah, knowing what, this is 10 years ago now almost, you know, and being, you know, a lot more mature, just thinking about like, damn, you know, I did that to myself, you know, being in there for so long, and, you know, it's just not a good place to begin with.
Do you think, as you were saying about it, having this strange kind of feeling, do you think the house felt challenged because you didn't go home, Daryl? And though it saw you as, and the rest of the investigators, it saw you as a temptation, as a challenge, because you saw it as the house that wouldn't break you guys either. You weren't
going right. Yeah, quite possibly. Now that you say it like that, yeah. I mean, I just think whatever is there needs that human energy to kind of like, you know, keep going, and it feeds off of it. It's just like, you know, it's kind of like an energy vampire of sorts. Like, it feeds off of energy. And I think that probably has something to do with it as well, that we, you know, we were almost like challenging it, which it wasn't our intent. Not that I can remember. Cause I don't think I even thought of it that way until, you know, now really, you know, like we probably were, you know, like it was like trespassing. We were trespassing on it, and like, okay, you're going to stay here. You're going to hang out. We're going to put you through the tests. And it did, man.
Have you had anything since then, Daryl, in the paranormal field that's... Because I would imagine, having gone through what you've gone through, as you explain in the book, and I don't want to sort of send any spoilers out for anybody that's yet to read it, so let's keep them tempted. I would imagine that whole experience of that night has basically stood you in good stead on the rest of your paranormal investigation career, because has it taught you what not to do, or how to sort of be a little bit more proactive in further investigations going forward?
Yeah. It humbled me as an investigator, and it made me recreate myself, almost rebuild myself as a not investigator, but as a human being. And it, like I said, I'm glad at this point, I wasn't happy with it, but at this point in my career, I am happy it happened to me, because if it didn't happen to me, where would I be? The direction I would be going in, would I be who I am now? I don't know. I can't answer that, but I just know I was heading, you know, straight down this road, and is like, you know, basically dead stop. All right, no, this is not good. This is not right. I got to change the way I'm doing things. And it sent me down a completely different direction. As an investigator, you know, back then I was, like I said, I was very immature. I mean, I'll admit it. I think we learn from our mistakes. Hopefully some of us do. I know I do. And I learned from it that, you know, that's not the way of doing things. And it changed me in ways that I can't really even explain as an investigator. Like, you know, I'm very humble now. I'm like, I don't go in, I don't open myself up to these things. I go in as a complete observer when I'm investigating, or, you know, if I'm with the public. And I try to teach that to the people who are coming out to my events and, you know, spending time with me, to this is the way you should do it. Now, I can't tell you how to do things, but this is, I'm going to suggest this is the way you do it, so you don't have the same problems I had, and learn from my mistakes. So definitely.
I find as well, like, it's a bit like a paranormal intervention then, Daryl. So they saw you going down a path that clearly that they thought your talents needed to be pushed in another direction. though I would suspect there are probably better ways to do it looking back.
Yeah. Definitely for me. For them, I mean, whatever it was, I mean, I don't think it knows any better than that. That's the way it does things. And it's, you know, it's probably done it that way. It's forever. So it's nothing going to change. It changed me. That's for damn sure. And in a good way. I think I paid my pound of flesh with that one. I'm still happy that it happened to me. Back then I wasn't, but now when I look back at it, you know, especially over the last few years, I'm like, okay, it had to happen. It happened for a reason. It had to happen. And I'm glad it did happen.
So it kind of reinvigorated you
reinvented me.
Yeah.
Reinvigorated me and reinvented me as, you know, as a lot of things, as a father, as an investigator, as just a human being, as a man. It just reinvented me and it helped me through a lot of things.
Do you think that's what's carried you through into sort of continuing to build on your love of the paranormal, Daryl? Because obviously you've done a lot since this event. This seems to be like the line in the sand that going forwards from this point, you've kind of really embraced things. You've been fortunate enough to be sort of headhunted for, you did a couple of seasons of that, I believe.
Ghost Hunters, yeah.
Yeah, Ghost Hunters, and covered that and did some great shows there. I mean, the Alaska investigation that I saw was quite a special one, I think.
Thank you. Yeah, that was, that's a whole nother undertaking. Oh my God. Yeah, Alaska. So even like almost all the episodes we did on Ghost Hunters, especially our second season, it was kind of funny to talk about it, but like our second season, we were like, okay, they're like, how can we amp it up? How can we make it different than the old blueprint? Because we felt like on the first season, we were like running off the old blueprint, which was nothing against it. It was stale at the time. Like we were like, okay, we need to change this up. So we all, you know, a couple of us went to production, you know, and we're like, hey, we need to change this. And how can we change it? And they're like, okay, well, if you want to change it, this is what we're going to do. We're going to put you in the most remote locations we can find. And you're not going to have all it's not going to be easy. Put it that way. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be a place you can fly, get out of get in a car and drive to your hotel in 5 minutes. You're going to fly to these locations and then you're going to have to take a boat to the location and you're going to have to drive to this location. And it was like that for every episode. These very remote locations that have never been done before. You had Wendover Air Base in Utah. You had, you know, Haines, Alaska that had never been investigated. You had, you know, Clifton, Arizona as a crazy episode. Galena, Illinois. You had all these crazy locations that are there. Fort Stanton, New Mexico, another one crazy. These off the wall spots that have never been investigated by a TV show, put it that way, and that were very remote and almost like lawless and dangerous locations, you know, at some points. Especially like, Clifton, Arizona. Very lawless. It's just like you step back in the 1870s. It was like that. Haines was one of those. It was like people, I don't think people realize what we actually went through with the weather there, because we actually got stranded out there for a couple extra days. At one point we thought our boat was going to capsize because the weather was so bad. We were trying to go back when we were leaving because we were there. We were supposed to be there for 2 weeks. And we filmed for the 2 weeks and we were supposed to leave. And as we were leaving, we got about an hour because it was like a 4 hour boat ride or 3 hour boat ride back to Juneau, Alaska. Yeah. And you have to cross this like bearing, like the what they call the straits.
Yeah.
And so we're out there. And the thing is, between January and March, almost April, they don't allow boats to run. Because the weather is so bad out there on the straits. So we had to charter our own ship. Like basically our production company paid the ship to come, and it was a huge, this is like a two-story ship to get all our stuff on air and production and us and get us to where we need to be. And on the way back, we were about an hour into the boat ride back and the weather was so bad. We were getting 10 to 15 foot swells going over the bow of the boat. And they had to turn the boat around and go back to Haines and like just dock it. It was just too bad. We had to stay an extra day or two. So yeah, it was pretty crazy, man. It was a lot to make that episode.
Yeah. Alaska certainly makes you realize what it is to be alive, I think, in a lot of ways.
People alone, man. Great people. But they're a different breed, man. Let me tell you, these people are like, it was funny because like the town we stayed in Haines, there's only two places to eat in town and they're both bars. And they stay open. Like the one, you know, it would be open at 6 a.m. and people would be in there sitting at the bar drinking at 6 a.m. That's their lifestyle, man. It's crazy. But yeah, it was very interesting being there. It was a good time. It's the first day we were there, it snowed 18 inches and it didn't stop. Every day it was either snow or freezing rain. You know, and it just combined, it'd be ice and snow. It was just, the weather was miserable. But it was a once in a lifetime experience, and I'm so glad we went.
Absolutely. Certainly puts hairs on your chest, I would imagine, Darryl, doing it.
It sure does.
So when you kind of look back now, because I think it's quite interesting, everything we've kind of discussed about your book, often people will say, oh, well, people always said I needed to write this book. But I think you've clearly written this for you. And if anybody else enjoys it, then that's a bonus.
Yeah, it was therapy. Because to that point, I mean, I've been talking about the House of Wills on podcasts, much like we're doing right now, radio shows. And it was always that question, what's your, craziest location, blah, blah, blah. And I would always tell them the House of Wills. Okay. It would always come up and I would give them the short version of it. And I would always get these people asking, man, you need to write a book about this place. I've never heard of it or I did hear of it. I was like, yeah, whatever. And then, when COVID hit, I had some time where, one night I just sat down and started writing. And I'm like, holy shit. It was like therapy. And I didn't stop for like three and a half months. Just kept writing, every other night or a couple times a week. And it was like rehashing it and getting it out and, remembering things that, I'd actually buried. And, in the back of my head. And it felt good to get it all out, man, and get it on paper. And then I have it on paper. I'm like, okay, now what do I do with it? It's all done. What do I do with it? So I started, I sat on it for a couple of months, 3 or 4 months. Just, it was there. And then I started pitching it around to publishers. And, Twin Llewellyn picked it up. And then it grew legs. Then they, hit me back up. Like, okay, we want the book. But we need you to add another 18,000 words, and you have to this day to get it done. Right? Oh, sorry. And you have to sit down and beef up chapters, or add new chapters. That's when I added. I think I added like the Fort Delaware stuff, or how I got started, and Ghost Hunter. I added chapters to it to kind of like the lead up to it and to end it, and And the next thing I know, boom. And they're like, okay, it's going into publication and it'll be out September 8th of next year. And that's been, 2 years ago now. And it just came out this September.
So I suppose there's a sense of relief and probably a lot of trepidation then, Darryl, when you release this book, because obviously it's quite a personal reveal for yourself in regards to you and your life, not only your paranormal investigation. So I suppose it's also cathartic for you in that regard that this is done now. It's behind you. You've got this book out there. You can now move forwards. So what are you looking at continuing to do next then, Darryl? Is it continuing to build up your paranormal experiences in other locations or?
Yeah, right now I think in the last couple of months it was, especially September, October, even August was building up to promoting the book, putting it out there. And I'm still doing that right now. Like every weekend I'm out on the road doing book signings or, promoting the book somewhere. And that's what I'm concentrating on right now for the rest of the year, just promoting it and pushing it, getting it out there, putting it in people's ears. And, I think, I've got some plans for next year. you know, with some people from the UK, some good people over there I met, and see where it goes. And I'll sort of let people know once I nail everything down and how I, in the direction we want to go with it. So, yeah. So, we'll see what happens with it. It's going to be pretty interesting though. It's a little bit different. Yeah.
Ah, interesting. Interesting. Intriguing. Was that all sort of, did they, pigeonhole you and corner you at the recent Festival of the Unexplained you spoke at?
Yeah, kind of. And plus I fell in love with the people over there, man. I really did. You know, you don't know until you're there, you know, and, it's just like people don't know until they come over here. Like they think it's the Wild West over here and everybody's shooting each other every freaking, you know, 15 minutes. It's not. It is what it is. But when you get over there and you start meeting the people and falling in love with the locations and just building, you know, new friendships and new directions to go in and to kind of to do something different, you know. And I fell in love with a certain place over there and some people and the way they do things. And we had a meeting. And so we'll see what happens, man. We're working on we'll probably start working on it in November, December. And I've got some producers over here that are getting on board as well. So we'll see how it goes.
Fantastic. I look forward to that. I look forward to that. So, Darren, where can everybody get a copy of the book? Follow your work online, keep up to date.
Yeah, I mean, if you can't come to one of my events or anything, go on Amazon. It's in all bookstores everywhere. It's on BarnesandNoble.com, Amazon.com. It's Books a Million, bookstores.org. It's and bookstores everywhere. So, I mean, you can get a book. Most people, I think, buy it through Amazon because it's so easy. You know, everyone has an Amazon account. Go out there, get a book, and give me a rating on Amazon and let me know what you think.
Absolutely. And where can they follow you online, Darrell? Keep up to date with what you're investigating or what you're up to.
Yeah. Best place to follow me is on Instagram. My Facebook accounts and everything are linked to my Instagram, but I don't do a lot on Facebook. But I post everything on Instagram. Just go to Darrell Marston Ghost Hunter, and it's got the little blue check mark next to my name. And, you can follow me on there. I always put up, you know, pictures of where I've been, things I'm doing and events that are coming up. You know, if you're in the area, you can stop by and see me, and have a good time.
Fabulous. Well, Darrell, like I say, I thoroughly enjoyed the book. Being scared on my behalf, I think, was very brave of you. So thank you for anybody who's going to read it. And I'm delighted to see how the experience has changed you in a positive way, because often it would have been very easy to deal with it negatively or perhaps not deal with it in such a proactive manner, which you have done clearly going forwards. Thank you again for your time. It's been a real pleasure. And once again, thank you for releasing such an interesting book.
Thank you. I appreciate the show. You're a great show, and thanks for all the compliments. And go check out the book, guys.